We know there are times where you're just too busy to sort through the mass of information that comes your way. So to make it easier for you to stay informed, subscribe to The Morning Agenda, WITF's news podcast, where the only agenda is you.
Funding for The Spark is provided by Capital Blue Cross, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Cross Connect Health and Wellness Centers, which provide in-person services and inspire healthy living. Learn more at capitalbluecross.com. The Spark is also supported by UPMC. Choose UPMC for your family's health care needs close to home. Visit upmc.com/centralPA for a complete list of services and locations.
Dr. Keisha Morant-Williams, who's an accomplished communicator, researcher, and advocate, and is committed to building human and social capital in academic and community spaces. She currently is the senior advisor for the College Diversity, Equity, and Belonging and professor of Humanities and Communication Arts at Elizabethtown College. And in this role, she provides college-wide vision and leadership with DEIB efforts. And Dr. Williams earned her PhD from the Department of Communication and Culture at The Howard University and received her Master's of Arts from Penn State University and her Bachelor's of Arts from Westchester University of Pennsylvania. And before joining Elizabethtown, Dr. Morant-Williams was an Associate Professor of Communication Arts and Sciences at Penn State University Berks, as well as being a contributor to the Huffington Post. And I'm happy and honored to have Dr. Morant-Williams here with us today to give us some insight on her background and what lies ahead for her and her students. So starting off here, do I call you Keisha? Do I call you Dr. Williams? You know, how do we set the stage for this interview?
Well, you know me. We've interacted quite a bit, so yes. Keisha is fine in this setting.
All right. So Keisha, can you tell us about your background and what got you into the world of academia?
Oh man. So my background, I am a kid who came from a family where my mother believed in education above all else, excluding God. And I always read, I was always writing, I was always doing all of the things. And when I was in graduate school, getting my master's degree, mm-hmm. I had an advisor who said, "What's next?" And mm-hmm. I was like, "I don't know, you know, I already had a job. I figured I would, you know, write my award-winning novel that I still believe I'm going to write someday and just, you know, kind of keep living." And he said, "Did you ever consider a PhD program?" And that's all it took. Like from there, in that moment, no, I hadn't. I considered a PhD program. I applied to two schools. I got into Howard, which was my top choice, and the rest is history.
All right. So your time at Howard now, this is a HBCU and it's your PhD program. So was there any kind of adjustment period for you?
Oh man, yes, it was. There was an extreme adjustment period. You know, I grew up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. I did go through the school district of Lancaster, which was, pretty diverse. But then when I went to undergrad and my master's degree, they both were at predominantly white institutions. Mm. And I think sometimes we don't realize like how much we just get used to a certain cadence or a certain pattern of ways of being. And so when I got to Howard, I often say it was culture shock. Mm. But it was shock in the sense, not just because I was surrounded by, you know, so many beautifully brilliant Black folks, but it was shock, I think, also in part because the openness, the expectation of faculty that they would have a chance to just get to know me, that I would come in and just sit down and talk, that they would become, you know, my auntie or, you know, an extended relative. Like my closest professor when I was there is family to me now. Like my kids call her, you know, their additional grandma. She came to my wedding. She came to their dedication. All of those things. So yeah, it was definitely a shock. I think the best academic decision I've ever made. But yes, it's absolutely a shock.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up because that really reminds me of going to Morgan State for my master's mm-hmm. program, and like that shock was always there, and I would tell myself, like, oh, okay, well, it's like this because I'm in a master's program. If I was an undergrad, mm-hmm. it would be just like Shippensburg. But talking to the undergrad students, like, they were getting that, you know, that auntie, unk still at that undergraduate level. So that whole just being immersed in the culture on the academic side was an eye-opener for me. So your time at Howard, what did you do and how did you grow?
Okay, so I have always been a communicator. I have the gift to gab. I think we have that in common. I love to talk. I love to smile. I love to listen. I consider myself a storyteller. Mm. I often describe myself as a narrative advocate. And Howard gave me the opportunity to do that, but to do that in a way that use theory, you know, that expanded my understanding, that helped me understand what NOMO was. So like the power of the spoken word and how that links to Afrocentricity and, you know, our history and just the beauty of language and all of those various components. Howard set me up in a way to be able to still incorporate that in my life in very, very many spaces, like the communality components, the collective identities. All of those things were what, you know, I feel like I got from Howard, even beyond like my traditional, you know, I sat in the class and I learned this about interpersonal communication or this about small group or this about health comm. I learned what it meant to deeply be immersed in communication and culture in a very meaningful way.
Now, this is a different kind of culture shock because you're from a small town called Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and then you ended up in you know, D.C., you know, the nation's capital. So can you take us back to your upbringing in Lancaster and talk to us about that and your parents as well?
All right, cool. So yes, born and raised in Lancaster, Lancaster General Hospital. School District of Lancaster, I often would make jokes, you know, that in Lancaster it was the Amish and the Outlets, you know, growing up, and the Black Church, you know, like that. Yeah. Those were the entities, and that's sort of where you got your identity or your framework. I remember even when I left for undergrad, I went to Westchester University. Mm. And I had a friend who I went to visit and, you know, most of my friends in undergrad were from Philly or, you know, from other areas. They weren't mm-hmm. necessarily from Lancaster. There was a group of us from Lancaster who went there, but our new friendship group. And I remember when I met my friend's mom, she admitted that she wasn't sure if I was Black because all she knew about Lancaster was the Amish and the Outlets. So that, you know, like when we think about that framework, I think sometimes we might assume that there wasn't like this deep, rich Black culture here. But I'd argue that I still experienced that as well. Mm-hmm. And I experienced that though more through the church. You know, like my parents were very invested in the church that I've attended most of my life. You know, they were two of the founders of the church. It was seven of them. Mm. My parents are the last two, you know, who are alive. And they always said, you know, God first, education second. And so sort of that blending of that, making sure that we were exposed to different things linked to our history and cultural experiences, like they did the best that they could with that.
Yeah.
I'd say that like when it comes to my parents, though, you know, they're both from South Carolina. They both migrated here, or moved here towards the end of the Great Migration. Mm. Same year. They didn't know each other, though. They met each other here. And I think that they were really intentional in making sure in their own ways, because while they both were from South Carolina, both were born in the same year, all of those sorts of things, their lived experiences were still very different. Mm. And I think that they were very intentional in instilling all of that in me. So my dad, for example, he was raised in an all-Black self-sustaining town in Georgetown County, named Jackson Village. Well, it's Plantersville, but Jackson Village is the smaller entity. And Jackson Village was actually named after one of my, you know, family members. So one of my descendants, Jack Morant. And so he was like completely, you know, immersed in Black culture, Black experience, teachers, doctors. Like I remember when we used to go down there was like a Morant Avenue and a Greg's Boulevard, you know, all of the folks who I was related to. And so imagine that was his lived experience. He didn't experience firsthand in your face racism until he moved north.
Wow.
Whereas my mom grew up in very, very, you know, stereotypical sharecropper Jim Crow South. Mm. And, you know, she had all of those experiences. So I think my childhood really blended both of those in, you know, some amazing ways.
Yeah. Now, I'll tell you this. I'm still looking. But let there be a Lupton Lane. And that's that. That'll be the last of it. My head will be so big. I'll be up there with Kate and Prince Harry if I find a Lupton Lane. I'll tell you that. So let's also talk about your writing. Because like you said, you are still working towards that novel. And I don't want to gloss over the fact that you were a contributor for the Huff Post. So can you talk to us about your writing style and how you were able to become a contributor for the Huff Post?
Again, always been a communicator, always been a writer. I have been writing as long as I, you know, knew how to form letters. I have journals from elementary school. I don't throw much of anything out. So it's always been a part of me, always been a part of my identity. I think as I got a little bit older, like even in upper elementary school, I won like the Burberry Award. It's like this, you know, little writing award. And my parents, again, found ways to continue to pour in this. I was always in writing workshops. I was always, going to journalism camps, all those types of things. And so when I finished undergrad, I was a reporter for Lancaster newspapers.
Mm.
And I did that for a couple of years. And then I transitioned into more community facing, still like the communication component, but maybe more press releases or writing up summaries for workplace fact sheets, those types of things. And I enjoyed that, but I missed the narrative voice. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I had the opportunity to do at Lancaster newspapers, they let me move around a lot. And I got to do a lot of features writing with which was then called Lifestyles. Like mm-hmm. It's different now, but it was a lifestyle section. And I found that those stories spoke to me in ways that, you know, the traditional news story didn't, while they were very valuable. But just that human interest that I was able to figure out how to center someone's lived experience through my words, that while there were the words that I pulled together, that I had the honor to share their story through their perspective. And so I continued to search for ways to do that. Even when I decided to be a college professor, yes, communication in a broader sense was a general track, but I still taught most of my classes through the narrative lens. Like I taught narrative health. I taught family narratives. I taught, you know, communicating care, all of the things. And within that, I would always ask people, if the story was about themselves, which one of your critical incidents or defining moments did you want to center? But then if we were doing work for other people, like we may have done collaborative community-based research with hospitals, how did we center, you know, those stories? And so I was always very, very intentional with that. A lot of my academic publications, even I tried to still find ways to incorporate things that the general population might still align with. And so I had a friend who was working for the Huffington Post as well. And I asked her, like, hey, you know, can you share some of my work? Do you think, you know, that I might be able to get an opportunity there? She said, absolutely. And they asked me to send a sample. And you know, pretty much that was it. It was a wonderful ride. They switched the platforms and the way that they were doing things. And that's why, you know, they no longer had the contributors. But it was a great opportunity to expand my platform, to get feedback from people who, you know, probably wouldn't have been exposed to me or my message. And it also really helped me shift into a different style of writing that I've really kind of center my work around now.
What are some of the things that you wrote about?
Okay. A lot of the things that I wrote about in the more academic spaces still linked to people who typically wouldn't be centered. So it might be Black women, or it might be students who are neurodiverse. It might be folks who have a, you know, non-dominant religious tradition, those kinds of things. Like that, that's sort of what I'm drawn to, is those stories that we might not hear over and over in mainstream. But I think I also am just really into writing about things that just pique a curiosity in me. So, you know, when I think about, even when my parents used to own a restaurant in Lancaster for many years, and one of the things that I remember most about it wasn't so much the food, but it was the gathering. Like it was that it had become a community space that people from all walks of life, like you could have, you know, been a person who perhaps was, you know, just getting back on track from making different life choices, all the way to like, you know, president of your bank or the fire chief or, you know, whoever. Everyone came in there. Everyone sat, everyone engaged. And I just loved watching the way that they interacted. And so sometimes I would watch the way, like the conversations that people who might not in other circumstances really talk to each other. And I guess in some respects I would eavesdrop and get, you know, story ideas or different thoughts from there. One in particular that I remember I actually used in my master's thesis was called Grits and Salmon. And that one was really about, of course, I changed their names, but it really was about the relationship between my dad and one of his friends. And as I mentioned, you know, my parents were founders, two of the founders of a church and so on and so forth. And so my parents are, you know, pretty committed to their faith and they're pretty religious. And this particular friend is spiritual, but, you know, he has a different approach to the way that he experiences his faith. And watching him and my dad interact and engage about life and things that they've experienced and so on and so forth, it just was such a beautiful experience. So that I ended up writing the story based on them and their interactions.
And then and then now to bring things current, you've done work with Penn Medicine. You've done work with Johnson & Johnson. You're a sought after keynote speaker and facilitator. And you are also at E-Town College now. Can you talk to us about your position that you are currently holding at E-Town?
Sure. My position at E-Town, I report directly to the president, and I am what's labeled as the senior advisor for college diversity, equity, and belonging. And so in other industries or so on and so forth, I would be the CDO, so the chief diversity officer. And what I'm responsible for doing there is looking at how do we ensure that our practices, our policies, procedures, the way that we're showing up, create an equitable experience for all of our students, but also our colleagues. And that's something that I found especially important, and I'd say also rewarding in this role, is that, of course, because it is a college, you know, students are central in this. But student experiences tend to be better if their faculty and staff experiences are wonderful as well. So if I come to work and I'm happier and I feel appreciated and I feel, you know, seen and heard and so on and so forth, I am showing up a better version of myself for the students who I am engaging with and interacting with. And so to really be able to intentionally do some work around those areas has been rewarding in ways that I didn't anticipate. You know, I wasn't really sure what to expect. I often made jokes when I accepted the position because I always said I would never, ever, ever take a job like this. but I felt like it just spoke to me in so many ways. And, you know, some folks who are closest to me, when I said, hey, I'm thinking about, you know, putting my name in for this, they were like, you know, it's yours. And so it's been, you know, quite an experience. Like there, you know, there are a lot of amazing awards. Of course, there's some challenges along the way as well. But I appreciate being able to use an approach and be supported in the approach that that centers the groups that typically do experience the inequities or the, the, you know, that aren't considered in many spaces. And that's what I said from day one, that I am not approaching this position from the perspective of trying to convince a racist not to be racist or trying to, you know, convince someone who doesn't believe in equitable practices to be equitable. I am approaching this from a position of these are the expectations of this institution or these are the expectations of this office and so on and so forth. And we are going to operate, you know, through that lens. We love, love, love for folks to come alongside with us. We love for folks to engage. We are completely okay with helping people learn and grow and all of those amazing things. But I do not have the energy or capacity to spend a whole lot of time on folks who have no desire to you know, to come alongside or grow or understand.
Yeah, and to follow up with that, how much did that experience with your car play into this transition? Because you said that you didn't feel safe. So I'm just assuming here that that's a slippery slope. Like once you start feeling unsafe at work, you know, there's other stuff that may follow. So how did that experience play into your transition to E-Town?
Yeah, yeah. So I want to clarify, as you just said, that they were two different institutions.
Yes.
And I think that incident, plus all of the things that were going on very publicly. Mm-hmm. Again, I want to make sure I stress publicly, because sometimes I think we think that certain activities or events weren't happening. But you know, in a very public space, I think like I started almost feeling like I was suffocating in where I had the access, I had the ability. And as I said, I knew that I had the privilege and the reach in certain circles to use my voice in ways that sometimes folks without those certain privileges, you know, are ignored. I had served in, you know, some volunteer roles. I was on my local school board and a couple of other things also before I applied for this position. And some of the things, again, that I experienced in those roles, again, it was during COVID. It was all during this exact same period, just made it like, Keisha, you keep trying to run away from this, but it's just following you, you know, in every way.
Oh, and there it is. Dr. Keisha Morant Williams, I want to thank you for joining us on The Spark today and just giving us this insight on your life and your academic journey. This has been fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you for having me.